Rose War by David Irving. Munich. When General Franz Halder first reported to the Führer as the new Chief of General Staff on board the Guerilla on August 22, 1938, Hitler had teased him, quote, "You will never learn my real intentions. Not even my closest colleagues, who are convinced that they know them, will ever find them out." End quote. One thing was certain. That summer, Hitler really wanted a war. Whether to write about the quote-unquote birth certificate of his new Reich in blood, or to, quote, forge the Austrians into a worthwhile component of the German Wehrmacht, unquote, as he explained to the generals on August 15th. Quote, "Clausewitz was right," he exulted to his adjutants upon leaving another military display in East Prussia some days later. "War is the father of all things," unquote. This was Hitler's favorite quotation. He repeated it in his secret speeches on May 20, 1942, on January 27, 1944, again on June 22, 1944, and in his war conference of January 9, 1945, when even his most ardent followers had long grown tired of Hitler's war. In 1938, he also told his generals that he wanted Germany's older troops, the 30 to 35-year-olds, to see some combat action in this Czech campaign. The young soldiers could taste blood in the next. Opinion at the top level was, and remained, divided as to whether Hitler was bluffing or not. Wiesacker wrote privately on September 1st, quote, "None of this would prevent me from laying a small wager even now that we shall preserve the peace in 1938, end quote. 3 days later, however, Ribbentrop again informed him that Green would begin, quote, "within 6 weeks," unquote. For technical reasons, Green could not begin before October 1st anyway, but equally, for the best flying weather, it ought not to be delayed after the 14th. The leader of the Sudeten German Party, Konrad Heinlein, was Hitler's quote-unquote secret weapon for breaching the Czech fortifications. Hitler had secretly counseled several times during July and August 1938 with Heinlein and his chief lieutenants. Heinlein was by no means enthusiastic about Green. At Bayreuth on July 23rd, he vainly tried to dissuade Hitler from using force. Hitler replied that his young Wehrmacht needed a taste of fire. At the Breslau Gymnastics Festival, a week later, they again met. Hitler invited him up to his hotel room. He told Heinlein he had nothing to add to the instructions he had long since given him. Evidently, this was an act for the benefit of the journalists ringing the hotel. In mid-August, Heinlein's course deputy, Karl Hermann Frenk, came to the chancellery and tried to convince Hitler that maps showed that the distribution of Czech and German population groups was such that quote-unquote self-determination alone would eventually bring Czechoslovakia into Hitler's grasp. He found he was talking to deaf ears. Hitler was out for blood. By this time, the Führer had begun examining with his OKW staff ways of controlling the crisis that would unleash Green. Goebbels recorded that the problem now was how could the Führer create, quote, "a suitable situation to strike," unquote. On August 26th, Hitler ordered Frenk to prepare to manufacture incidents in the Sudeten territories. The snag was the British negotiating team now lodged in Prague under a venerable liberal peer, Lord Runciman. Outwardly, Hitler had to appear to be heeding the British proposals. He, of course, wanted all Czechoslovakia, not just control of the Sudeten regions. This explains Hitler's irritation when Heinlein's Berlin agent, Fritz Berger, brought the Runciman proposals to Munich on August 29th. Quote, "What business do the British have poking their noses in?" unquote, exclaimed Hitler. Quote, "They ought to be looking for their Jews in Palestine," end quote. An apprehensive Konrad Heinlein appeared at the Berghof on September 1st. Goebbels had also come, and Hitler told them that the gap in their country's western defenses was virtually closed. Quote, Britain, he prophesied, will hold back because she does not have the armed might. Paris will do what London does. The whole affair must unroll at top speed. For high stakes, you've got to run big risks, unquote. Goebbels noted these words with ill-concealed apprehension. Hitler showed Heinlein over Bormann's model dairy, built at great expense to supply the SS barracks. Quote, God knows the price of a pint of milk, unquote, Hitler used to bully him. A pint of your milk. He wisecracked to Heinlein, quote, here are the representatives of the National Socialist Cow Club, unquote. He was evidently in high spirits, but Heinlein was not. Hitler repeated that he was still planning a military solution. Czechoslovakia was to be eliminated, quote, this September, unquote. Heinlein was to keep on negotiating with Prague and start manufacturing, quote-unquote, incidents from September 14th. On the 2nd, Hitler delivered another little homily to his cronies, Goebbels, Heinlein, Ribbentrop, Bormann, Speer, and Hoffmann, on, quote, keeping one's nerve, unquote. Seeing Heinlein off at 3:30 p.m., Hitler is alleged to have laughed, quote, long live the war, even if it lasts 8 years, end quote. Perhaps it was all bluff. There are clues that Hitler was using Heinlein as a powerful psychological weapon. For instance, a secret directive to the Nazi press a few days later, quote, there's to be a reception at Nuremberg. Heinlein is not being mentioned in the official report on this, but there is no objection to the publication of photographs that may show him attending this reception, end quote. Heinlein was not alone in his anxiety. The conservative Minister of Finance, Count Schwerin von Krosigk, sent to Hitler a memorandum formulated in quite clever terms. The German public lacked the inner resolution to fight a new war. It will not be able to bear for long the hardships of, quote, it will not be able to bear for long the hardships of war, large and small. The ration cards, the air raids, the loss of husbands and sons, end quote. So wrote Krosigk on September 1st in his memorandum. In his speech to Nazi editors 2 months later, Hitler would refer to, quote, the hysteria of our top 10,000, end quote. He turned an equally deaf ear on his diplomats. The moderate Konstantin von Neurath tried to see him and was refused. When his ambassador in London tried to bring him a private message written by Neville Chamberlain, Hitler refused to receive him, too. When his ambassador in Paris quoted to Berlin the French foreign minister's clear warning that France would stand by Czechoslovakia, Hitler pushed the telegram aside and said it did not interest him. Hans Dieckhoff, his ambassador in Washington, was given equally cavalier treatment. All three ambassadors demanded to see Hitler. It was not until the party rally, however, that he condescended. Turning to Wiedemann and instructing, quote, well, show the arseholes in, end quote. On Ribbentrop's advice, he instructed all three ambassadors not to return to their posts for the time being. Wiesacker indignantly wrote for the record, quote, after hearing out Messrs. Dieckhoff, von Dirksen, Count Velchek, Hans Adolf von Moltke, ambassador in Warsaw, and Hans George von Mackensen, Rome, on September 7th, I reported as follows to Herr von Ribbentrop on the 8th. Quote, the opinion of all these gentlemen is, with certain shades of difference, in flat contradiction to that of Herr von Ribbentrop, inasmuch as they do not believe that the Western democracies will abstain in the event of a German-Czech conflict, unquote. I added that my own opinion is well enough known to Herr von Ribbentrop as it is, end quote. Hitler's own routine was hardly that of a dictator preparing for war. He was to be seen spending the day visiting galleries in Munich. He inspected the models of Speer's new chancellery building and paintings for the, quote, Führer building, unquote, Führerbau. the party HQ. The evening was passed idly at the Berghof, watching two unsatisfying Hollywood movies, both of which Hitler peremptorily halted in mid-reel. After midnight of August 30th to 31st, Major Schmunt brought planning papers relating to the phony quote-unquote incident that was to be staged to justify Green. The OKW argued for the main incident to be staged when the weather was favorable for the Luftwaffe, and it must be early enough in the day for authentic word to reach OKW headquarters in Berlin by noon of the day before the Nazi invasion. It would put the Germans in enemy territory at the mercy of the Czechs and prevent the issue of any warning to diplomatic missions in Prague before the first air raid. It would, however, satisfy for Hitler his vital condition for success, surprise. Halder outlined the general staff plan to Hitler and Keitel aboard the Grilla at Kiel, using a map of Czechoslovakia. The country would be bisected at its narrow waist. To Hitler, this seemed wrong. This was precisely what the enemy would expect. He asked Halder to leave the map, and after returning to Berlin, he instructed Brauchitsch that the tanks were to be employed quite differently, concentrated into one force, which would drive northeastward from Nuremberg, through the Czech fortifications and Pilsen, and straight on to Prague. The political objective was to capture Prague, the Czech capital, in the first few days. The general staff disagreed with Hitler's plan. He summoned Brauchitsch to the Berghof on September 3rd and dinned into him why he insisted on his own plan. Originally, he said the Czechs had not prepared their defenses in anticipation of attack from Austria, so their fortifications facing Rundstedt and Silesia were far stronger. Quote, "The Second Army might run slap into a second Verdun. If we attack there, we shall bleed to death attempting the impossible." End quote. What the Czechs would not expect would be the attack Hitler planned to deliver with Reichenau and a massed force of tanks. Quote, "An army plunged into the heart of Bohemia will settle the issue." End quote. The general staff simply ignored Hitler's plan. Halder told Keitel that the orders had already gone out and it was too late to alter them. Keitel flew to Berlin early on September 8th and urged Brauchitsch to comply. When, however, the OKW chief returned to Hitler in Nuremberg, where the party rally was approaching its spectacular climax, the next morning all he could report was that both Brauchitsch and Halder flatly refused to alter their plans. The two reluctant generals were summarily ordered down from Berlin and presented themselves that night at Hitler's Nuremberg hotel, the Deutscher Hof. The row lasted 5 hours. Halder stated the general staff case. Hitler replied that they should plan with regard to the enemy's most probable line of action. Quote, "No doubt," he conceded, "your planned pincer operation is the ideal solution. Its outcome, however, is too uncertain for us to rely on, particularly since for political reasons we must obtain a rapid victory." End quote. He reminded them that history alone showed how hard it was to call off an operation that had only half succeeded. That was the familiar road to horrors like Verdun. The tanks would be frittered away piecemeal, and when they were needed for the subsequent operations in depth, they would not be there. All this now seems self-evident, but at the time, in September 1938, it was by no means so obvious that Hitler was right. The two generals still refused to give way. In the small hours of the morning, Hitler finally ceased reasoning with them and ordered them to redeploy the tanks as he had said. They had until the end of the month to do it. Halder shrugged, but Brauchitsch startled everybody with an effusive declaration of loyalty. After they had gone, Hitler ventilated to Keitel his anger about these cowardly and hesitant army generals. Quote, "It's a pity I can't give my Gauleiters each an army. They've got guts, and they've got faith in me." End quote. To shame these defeatist generals, Hitler alluded to them in withering terms at the Nuremberg rally. While they listened stonily from the front rows, he announced the award of the national prize to Fritz Todt for building the West Wall, a gratuitous slight to the army engineers. Only about 40,000 labor service conscripts could be spared for the rally. The rest were working on the wall. For 5 hours on the 11th, Hitler stood in his car at Adolf Hitler Platz, hatless under the broiling September sun, taking the salute as 120,000 SA and SS men marched past, breaking into the spectacular, high-kicking parade step as they came within sight of their Führer. He joked weakly with the diplomats at their formal reception, and even allowed the French ambassador to press a lily into his hands, the symbol of France. Quote, "It is a sign of peace as well," unquote, explained François Poncet eloquently, quote, "and should be worn by those who desire to work for peace," end quote. Hitler divested himself of the lily as soon as he decently could. The German newspaper headlines read, quote, "Self-determination for the Sudetenland. The Führer demands an end to slavery," end quote. On September 13th, Prague proclaimed martial law around the city of Eger. Things were going just as Hitler planned. The Nazi press proclaimed next day, quote, "Czech murder terror nears anarchy. Germans slain by Czech guns," unquote. From the Sudeten town of Asch on the evening of the 14th, Karl Frank telephoned Hitler to appeal for the German troops and tanks to intervene right now. Hitler responded, quote, "Frank, bide your time. The time isn't right yet," end quote. Indeed, it was not. Late the previous night, September 13th, the British ambassador had handed to Baron von Weizsäcker a letter in which Neville Chamberlain, aged nearly 70, offered to fly at once to Hitler to find a peaceful solution. Hitler could hardly have refused Chamberlain's offer and was nettled to have lost the initiative like this, however briefly. The quote-unquote brown pages, top-secret wiretaps by Göring's Forschungsamt, were pouring into the Berghof on the 14th by courier. Only that morning, Jan Masaryk, the volatile Czech envoy in London, had talked to his foreign ministry in Prague. Quote, "But if he," that is Hitler, "marches," Prague had asked him, "then everybody else will march, won't they?" End quote. Masaryk was not so hopeful. Quote, "I think after a while they will. People here won't look me in the eye. They're just an uncouth rabble," unquote. The voice in Prague exclaimed, quote, "No, impossible. They're just stupid people who have got 15 cruisers," explained Masaryk, "and they're frightened of losing them," end quote. He said that as for France, quote, "there are quite a few ragamuffins there, too," end quote. The tone of these remarks told Hitler volumes about morale in London and Prague. Hitler's illicit knowledge of these conversations explains much of his confidence. The wiretaps showed significantly that Chamberlain was delaying Masaryk's incoming telegrams from Prague for days on end. Thus, ironically, Masaryk was obliged to rely even more heavily on the telephone lines to Prague. The daily FA wiretaps showed the Czech envoy mouthing obscene insults about the Western statesman, appealing to Prague for still more cash, urgently, and plotting with Churchill and his Paris colleague the early overthrow of the Chamberlain and Daladier regimes. At 9:50 p.m. on September 14th, 1938, Masaryk put through an urgent call to Dr. Benes himself, quote, "Have you heard about Chamberlain?" unquote. Quote, "No," unquote. Quote, "He's flying to Berchtesgaden at 8:30 a.m. tomorrow," unquote. The wiretap analysis continued. Quote, after a lengthy pause, Benes exclaimed, obviously horrified, "It's not possible," end quote. Masaryk replied that Chamberlain would be accompanied by, quote-unquote, "that swine, Sir Horace Wilson." The next day, a 30-man SS guard of honor formed on the terraces outside the Berghof. At 6, the English party arrived. Chamberlain was in the familiar dark suit and stiff wig collar with a light-colored necktie and a watch chain across his coat. Upstairs in his study, Hitler launched into his usual tirade about the mounting Czech terror campaign. He complained that 300 Sudeten Germans had been killed already. Chamberlain had not, however, come to talk of war. Quote, "If Herr Hitler really wants nothing more than the Sudeten German regions," he said in effect, "then he can have them," end quote. Hitler, taken aback, assured him he had no interest whatever in non-Germans. In fact, Chamberlain had thrown something of a spanner in the works of Green. The Führer, however, was buoyant as he discussed the conversation that evening with Ribbentrop and Wiesacker. The latter wrote this personal record. Quote, "By making no bones about his brutal intention of settling the Czech problem now, even at the risk of a general European war, and by indicating that he would be content in Europe, he," that is Hitler, "had prodded Chamberlain into undertaking to work toward the ceding of the Sudeten regions to Germany. He," the Führer, "had not been able to refuse a plebiscite. If the Czechs reject this, the way will be clear for a German invasion. If the Czechs yield, then Czechoslovakia's own turn will not come until later. For instance, next spring. There are, in fact, distinct advantages in disposing of the first Sudeten-German stage amicably." In this confidential discussion, the Führer did not conceal that he has taken a future war into account, and is fostering much further-reaching plans. For this, he volunteered not only nationalist motives, but what might be termed educational ones as well, or ones of latent dynamism. He radiated self-confidence and fearlessness in war and foreign policy, and spoke quite unambiguously of his own personal responsibility for steering Germany through the inevitable passage of arms with her enemies in his own lifetime. The Führer then related a number of details of his talk with Chamberlain itself, the little tricks of bluff and bluster with which he had fenced his conversation partner back into his corner. End quote. A year later, Wiesacker recalled, quote, "From the Reich Chancellery emanated the slogan that Germany's youth needed a war to steel itself. The war against Czechoslovakia took on the character of art for art's sake." End quote. In fact, Chamberlain and the French proposed to give Hitler all areas with over 50% German population. Not surprisingly, Jan Masaryk was heard frantically telephoning Dr. Benes after Chamberlain's return to London, complaining that, quote-unquote, uncle had not yet told anybody anything about his Berghoff talk with Hitler. The Czech envoy added delicately, quote, "May I ask for money to be sent if I am to do anything? I need just enough, you understand." End quote. Benes did, quote, "I will put it in hand at once," end quote. Wiesacker's record leaves no doubt that Hitler had no intention of letting Chamberlain fob him off with just the Sudeten regions. He had to tread very cautiously for a while, however. When Canaris telephoned the Berghoff to ask whether his guerrilla and sabotage units there should start their dirty work, Keitel instructed, quote, "No, not for the time being," unquote. Hitler had developed a surer method. A free corps, ostensibly raised spontaneously by the aggrieved Sudeten Germans inside the Czech frontier. In fact, about 10,000 of Heinlein's supporters had fled into Germany over the last week. Hitler ordered the Wehrmacht to equip them with suitable weapons, Austrian-made Mannlicher rifles, and to return the men to Czechoslovakia under cover of darkness. These irregulars would be aided by regular German army and SA officers as advisors, and provided with motor transport by the party. Hitler disclosed this plan to Karl Hermann Frank on September 16th in a two-hour conference. The Heinlein Free Corps would carry out commando-type sorties into Czech frontier positions each night. Their aim would be, as Schmunt explicitly telegraphed to the OKW next day, quote, to keep up the level of disturbances and clashes, end quote. In the summer of 1937, Martin Bormann had observed how his chief liked strolling down to the tea pavilion. He decided to construct for the Führer a new tea house to rival any other in the world. That August, Bormann had selected the craggy peak of the 5,500-foot Kelstein, not far from the Berghof, and personally hammered in the marking pegs together with Fritz Tott. By September 16, 1938, this eagle's nest was finished. At 4 p.m., Hitler, Tott, and Bormann drove up to the new Eyrie, Bormann proud but Hitler skeptical. He had known nothing of Bormann's surprise plan until it was too late to revoke. According to Julius Schaub, Hitler blamed it on Bormann's folie des grandeurs, smiled indulgently, and let himself be persuaded that it would serve to impress foreign visitors. The new road ended some way below the Kelstein's peak. A parking area had been blasted out of the rock face, into which were set massive bronze doors, topped with a granite slab reading, quote, built 1938, unquote. The doors swung open, and the car drove on into the mountain along a 170-yard tunnel wide enough for two cars to pass. At the tunnel's end was a circular vault, not unlike a church choir. Facing them were bronze sliding doors. Bormann invited Hitler into the windowless room beyond the doors, an elevator with walls of polished brass, mirrors, and upholstered chairs. They were lifted to the very crest of the Kelstein. As Hitler stepped out, he found himself looking over a view even more majestic than from the Berghof. Hitler spent an hour up here. He was, in fact, silently alarmed by the thumping of his heart at this altitude, and he was short of breath. This he told his doctors. On the next day, the 17th, he took Dr. Goebbels and his senior henchmen up to this mountaintop retreat and briefed them about the talks with Chamberlain, this quote-unquote ice-cool, calculating Englishman. He expressed high praise for their propaganda effort, saying, quote, we've half won the war already, unquote. Goebbels was optimistic that Prague would buckle under the war of nerves, but Hitler disagreed. Quote, in 1948, he explained, it will be just 300 years since the Peace of Münster. We've got to liquidate that peace treaty by then. End quote. He visited this lofty Eyrie only once more over the next few days, and only seldom afterward. There were now 2 weeks to go before Green. At training grounds on the periphery of Czechoslovakia, carefully phased maneuvers were beginning. Chamberlain had promised to return with his cabinet's agreement. Hitler was well informed on developments in London. He knew that French Premier Edouard Daladier and Foreign Minister Georges Bonnet had arrived in London on the 18th. At 1:20 p.m. on the 19th, Masaryk was heard plaintively telephoning Beneš. Quote, the uncles here are in session and haven't breathed a word to anybody yet. End quote. Beneš referred to the rumors that he had heard involving Hungary and the Carpatho-Ukraine. In his view, all such plans were quite out of the question. But Masaryk confirmed, quote, they are talking about ceding territories and such like, you know. Unquote. After more discussion, Masaryk added vehemently, quote, I haven't the slightest intention of going over there to Downing Street. They haven't sent for me, so what I say is fuck them, Mr. President. End quote. During the afternoon, the Anglo-French plan was finally communicated to Beneš, but not to Masaryk. It virtually instructed Beneš to surrender. He was to cede to Hitler all areas with more than 50% German population. Beneš told Masaryk the gist of it on the phone at 7 p.m. and asked what people like Churchill thought. Masaryk responded, quote, when I asked them, they hoped we won't take it lying down, end quote. He added, quote, 75% would be one thing, but 50%, that's impossible, end quote. Beneš sighed, quote-unquote, frightful, For the next 2 days, Prague officially remained silent. Venice was heard explaining to Masaryk that he was searching for some formula, neither yes nor no, to enable him to keep honorably negotiating. Masaryk referred contemptuously to Chamberlain's approaching return to Germany, quote, "The old man's packing his bags again. He's in quite a dither," end quote. Again, he asked for funds to be urgently rushed to him in London. Quote, "The balloon will soon go up and I'll find myself without a penny," unquote. By early September 19th, Heinlein's Free Corps terror squads had begun operations. The Czech army was moved closer to the border. Hitler's own generals persuaded him to limit the Free Corps operations, therefore to 12-man commandos or smaller. That day he resumed his wooing of the Hungarians. Horthy, by now again in Germany as Goering's guest on a shoot, had written privately to Hitler expressing alarm over newspaper reports that Venice was about to cede the German-speaking regions to the Reich, quote, "leaving everything else as it was," unquote. The letters amongst Horthy's papers in Budapest. Hitler discussed this with Imrady and Kanya at the Berghof on September 20th. At 4 p.m. the same day, Hitler received Joseph Lipsky, Warsaw's ambassador to Berlin. Hitler had wooed Poland, Czechoslovakia's other neighbor, since mid-July. Goebbels had briefed Nazi editors not to report anti-German incidents in Poland, quote, "for the time being." On September 6th, Hans Fritzsche had repeated Goebbels' directive, quote, "there are to be no reports published on incidents in Poland, however much we may regret it," end quote. And 3 days later, there had followed this telling explanation, quote, "it is a basic principle of the Third Reich foreign policy only to tackle one thing at a time," end quote. Now Hitler had the reward for his forbearance. The Polish ambassador coyly confirmed the Warsaw government's predatory interest in Tessin, and assured Hitler that the Poles, quote, "would not shrink at all from using force," unquote. A day or two later, as Hitler, Ribbentrop, and Goebbels set off together for Bad Godesberg, Hitler repeated to them that Ambassador Lipsky had, quote, "promised," unquote, that Poland would use force against Czechoslovakia. It was all very satisfactory. Hitler and Ribbentrop drove complacently to Pollock and spent the evening at Bormann's home. By midnight, Hitler knew that Chamberlain would be coming to Bad Godesberg to meet with him on the 22nd. At 2 a.m. on September 21st, the British and French envoys in Prague jointly called on Venice to accept their Anglo-French plan, quote, "before creating a situation for which France and Britain could take no responsibility," end quote. 6 hours later, Goering's wiretappers found a cryptic telephone conversation going on between Prague and Paris. The Prague end announced that they had been forced to accept the plan since both Britain and France had threatened to leave Czechoslovakia in the lurch completely otherwise. The wiretaps indicated that Churchill was promising Masaryk that Chamberlain would be overthrown by that afternoon, that three ministers in Paris had cabled written protests to Daladier, and that, quote, "that oaf," unquote, Bonnet, was on his way out too. Masaryk's British friends were urging Prague to delay any formal decision on the plan until the 26th, at least. Masaryk's voice was heard adjuring Venice, quote, "Mr. President, one thing is most important. Public support here is growing like wildfire. That is what Churchill, Eden, and the Archbishop want you to know," end quote. Now Hitler knew it too, and forewarned was forearmed. On first hearing that Prague was minded to accept, he had instructed his OKW to consider the administrative problem of an unopposed occupation of the German-speaking areas. Now, however, the FA wiretaps decided Hitler differently. It seemed that Venice was going to play for time. Chamberlain arrived at the Cologne airport on September 22nd. He brought Sir Horace Wilson, quote-unquote, that swine, with him, as before. At the Rhine Hotel Driessen in Gottesberg, Chamberlain reminded Hitler of their Berghof agreement. Hitler solemnly pronounced, quote, I'm frightfully sorry, but that won't do any longer, end quote. He now insisted on the Wehrmacht being permitted to occupy the German-speaking areas of Czechoslovakia immediately. Chamberlain protested that Hitler had broken his word. After 3 hours of listening to Hitler's verbose arguments, he reclined on a sofa and announced he had done what he could. His conscience was clear. As neither side would yield, the talks were broken off, and the British delegation returned by ferry to their splendid Hotel Petersburg. In May 1942, Hitler referred to the quote-unquote two-faced British behavior here, the FA wiretaps he knew of their private from the FA wiretaps he knew of their private willingness to make the concessions he needed, but publicly they still dug their heels in. His annoyance was increased by the studied insolence of the British delegation and their sloppy attire. He later rebuked Henderson, quote, If any more people in tired suits call on me, I'll send my ambassador in London to see your king in a pullover. Tell that to your government, end quote. For several hours, Hitler delayed the next meeting while his codebreakers deciphered Chamberlain's secret report to his cabinet. The Prime Minister's next step was thus not unexpected. On September 23rd, he sent a note to Hitler explaining that British public opinion would not tolerate the new German demands. Hitler replied that he mistrusted the Czechs. They were playing for time. Chamberlain replied tersely, asking the Führer to set down his proposals in a memorandum. The document was handed to Chamberlain on his return to Hitler's hotel that evening at 10. Almost at once, at 10:30 p.m., a messenger brought a note to Hitler. Quote, Venice has just announced general mobilization over Czech radio, unquote. That galvanized the meeting. Hitler stood up and declared that that was that. Chamberlain also stood up and calmly prepared to leave. This was not what Hitler wanted at all. He was saved by Ribbentrop, who suggested that as the British had asked for the memorandum, they should at least read it. They sat down. The document laid down a deadline. The Czechs were to begin evacuating the German areas on the 26th and complete it by the 28th. Chamberlain rightly objected that this was just a dictate. Hitler smugly replied, quote, It isn't. Look, it's headed memorandum, end quote. Under pressure, he did, however, agree to relax the deadline to October 1st. His secret X-Day for green. Quote, You know, he flattered Chamberlain, you're the only man I've ever made a concession to, end quote. He had used the same words to Schuschnigg at the Berghof in February. At 1:15 a.m., the Führer bade him farewell. This was his last territorial claim in Europe, he assured him. Chamberlain replied, quote-unquote, Auf Wiedersehen. Hitler sat in the hotel garden for some time, watching the Rhine swirl past. After a while, he turned and thanked Ribbentrop for having intervened earlier. Quote, You saved the day for us, end quote. Chamberlain reported the next afternoon to his cabinet. There's an asterisk. At 3:30 p.m., Chamberlain told his inner cabinet he thought he had, quote, established some degree of personal influence over Herr Hitler, unquote. He felt Hitler would not go back on his word. At 5 p.m., he told the full cabinet that Hitler was, quote, extremely anxious to secure the friendship of Great Britain. It would be a great tragedy if we lost an opportunity of reaching an understanding with Germany, end quote. He believed that Hitler now trusted him. That's the whole asterisk. Masaryk in London was heard sneering on the phone to Benes. Quote, The Germans made such mincemeat of him that this morning he could barely manage a stutter, end quote. When Masaryk mentioned the rumor that Hitler was demanding that the Czechs should allow the Wehrmacht in at once, Benes exploded. Quote, Out of the question! We can't give up our positions, end quote. Hitler's lunch table was dominated by the question whether Beneš would give way. He himself was sure that the Czech president would not, while Goebbels argued that he would. Hitler repeated that his army would attack on or after the 28th. Quote, "That gives the Führer 5 days," unquote, Goebbels realized. Quote, "He fixed these dates way back on May 28th," unquote, he added. That Prague was standing firm was quite pleasing to Hitler. France had also begun partial mobilization, however, and Hitler had not bargained for that to happen until X day itself. Moreover, elements of the British fleet had put to sea. On September 25th, France, Britain, and Czechoslovakia all rejected Hitler's Gettysburg Memorandum. As Beneš told Masaryk to make clear in announcing this to London, the map forwarded by Chamberlain with the memorandum, quote, "would mean nothing more nor less than the immediate surrender of our whole nation into Hitler's hands," end quote. He added, quote, "show them all on the map how our nation is to be destroyed," Masaryk replied, end quote. Masaryk replied, quote, "so far they haven't given me the map. It's a shabby trick," end quote. On September 26th, 1938, Hitler summoned Keitel and told him that Green would start on the 30th. Turning the FA wiretaps on Masaryk over in his hands with their almost untranslatable obscenities about Chamberlain and Sir Horace Wilson, he saw a possibility of driving a wedge into the enemy camp. He instructed Goering to disclose the intercepts to Ambassador Henderson. When Wilson personally came to Berlin to put to him Chamberlain's latest proposal, Hitler, who already knew of it thanks to Masaryk's loquacity on the phone, dismissed it as valueless so long as Prague would not accept the Gettysburg terms. He bragged to Goebbels that he had yelled at the Englishman and accused him of evasions. Quote, "The Führer," wrote Goebbels, "believes in his mission with the sureness of a sleepwalker. Not for one moment does his hand tremble. A great genius in our midst," unquote. Hitler now dictated to Henderson that he would give Beneš until Wednesday the 28th to accept. Quote, "midnight Wednesday?" the British ambassador somewhat ambiguously asked. "No, by 2 p.m., said Hitler, and end quote. It's two different quotes there, I messed up. Thus the normal ultimatum was spoken. The formal ultimatum. The pressure on the Führer was steadily increasing, however. Lord Rothermere privately cabled him to think twice before making the scheduled speech at the Berlin Sport Palace that evening. The speech was rowdy and provocative. Hitler declared that his troops would march into the Sudeten German areas in 5 days' time on October 1st. Quote, "Our mind is made up. It is up to Herr Beneš now," end quote. Shortly after Sir Horace Wilson left the next morning, Hitler sent Schmundt to Keitel with written instructions that the initial shock troops were to move up to a line from which they could attack on the 30th. He ordered the Free Corps to step up its terrorist activities. He also directed that a mechanized division rumble through the streets of central Berlin. Goebbels mingled with crowds in the streets and found them baffled and anxious at the martial display. Quote, "the public is filled with a profound worry," he recorded. "They know we're coming into the last lap now," end quote. Did he still want war? Wiesacker, who appeared after midnight, found the Führer sitting alone with Ribbentrop. Hitler curtly announced that he would now wipe out Czechoslovakia. Wiesacker noted some days later, quote, "This was said only in the presence of Ribbentrop and myself, so it would be incorrect to assume that the Führer was just putting up a huge and monstrous bluff. It was his resentment over May 22nd, when the British jeered at him for, quote-unquote, backing down, that was propelling him along the path to war," end quote. It is possible that Hitler knew from the FA wiretaps that Wiesacker was conniving with the British diplomats. In the coming hostilities, Hitler wanted the SS to play an important part. He arranged for two Death's Head battalions to be equipped with anti-tank and field guns to protect an, quote, autonomous Sudeten German government, unquote, being set up at Asch, now wholly occupied by Heinlein's troops. In the Jaurnig enclave south of Breslau, Heinlein had already seized power. Control over Heinlein's Free Corps would pass to Himmler on the day that Green began. Hitler's ultimatum would expire at 2 p.m. the next day, the 28th. His military attaché in Paris estimated that France could assemble her first 65 divisions on the West Wall by the sixth day of mobilization. In an internal conference, Goering grimly conceded that war seemed inevitable and might well last 7 years. Early on the 28th, the naval attaché telephoned from London that a reliable source had just informed him that King George VI, upon whose, quote, vacillation, unquote, Hitler had been relying, had signed the order for mobilization. Only the date needed to be inserted. At 10 a.m., Brauchitsch saw Keitel and begged him to prevail on the Führer not to invade more than just the Sudeten areas. Canaris's estimation was that war with the West was certain. General Halder, the new chief of general staff, was seen in a state of nervous collapse, sobbing helplessly. Worse, by midday, Berlin knew that the British fleet had mobilized. Hitler undoubtedly realized now that his blackmail would profit him no more. It was this news of the Royal Navy's mobilization, he is said to have frankly admitted to Goering later, that tilted the balance for him. Early on the 28th, the French ambassador, François Poncet, asked to see Hitler to bring secret new proposals from Bonnet, of which even the Czechs were still unaware. An interview was arranged for noon. Shortly before noon, Hitler was in conference with Ribbentrop when Goering arrived with word, which his Forschungsamt may have obtained, that Mussolini had telephoned the Italian ambassador in Berlin a few minutes before 11 to say that Chamberlain had just contacted him. Mussolini wanted the Führer to know that he'd backed him to the hilt, but would Hitler be willing to postpone mobilization by 24 hours? A heated discussion broke out in Hitler's cabinet room. Goering accused Ribbentrop of actually wanting a war. Hitler tersely silenced them both. Quote, Ribbentrop, noted Goebbels, who had arrived for lunch, nurtures a blind hatred of Britain. Goering, Neurath, and I urge Hitler to accept the ambassador's proposals. Goering totally shares my viewpoint and gives Ribbentrop a piece of his mind. End quote. Over lunch, Goebbels could contain himself no longer and stated bluntly, quote, Mein Führer, if you think that the German public is thirsting for war, you are wrong. They watch its approach with a leaden sense of apathy. End quote. At noon, François Poncet was shown in. The new Bonnet plan which he brought was an improvement, but not enough. Almost at once, an adjutant handed to Hitler a folded note. The Italian ambassador was outside. Hitler excused himself, saying, quote, I'm wanted on the phone, and went out to receive the Mussolini message. End quote. He agreed to postpone the deadline by one day. The British were also stirring. The FA is certain to have intercepted Chamberlain's sensational telephone message to his Berlin embassy at 11:30, announcing that he was ready to come to Germany yet again. Hitler returned to François Poncet, but almost immediately the Italian ambassador was back. Mussolini had telephoned that Chamberlain had a proposal to make that would be a, quote, grandiose victory, end quote. At 12:30 p.m., as François Poncet was leaving, Henderson arrived with Chamberlain's formal proposal for a five-power conference. Quote, I am ready, wrote the elderly British Prime Minister, to come to Berlin myself. End quote. Hitler dictated a brief summary of his minimum demands for the Italian ambassador to forward to Mussolini. Thus peace seemed assured. Hitler was still eating when Ambassador Attolico returned at 2:40 p.m. He welcomed the Italian with his mouth still full. Italico made a brave effort to speak German. Quote, 11 a.m. in Munich. Hitler laughed out loud. During the afternoon, formal invitations were issued. Formal invitations were issued to the other two powers, Britain and France. Neither declined. Czechoslovakia was not invited. At 8:50 p.m. that September 28th, Hitler's special train hauled out of Berlin's Anhalt station en route to Munich for the historic conference. By 9:30 a.m., he was awaiting Mussolini's train at the small German frontier station. The Duce entered the Führer's saloon car with Count Ciano. As the train started back toward Munich, Hitler chortled out loud at the way, quote, we two revolutionaries, unquote, were managing to set Europe alternately by the ears. Keitel sketched in the military situation confidentially to the Duce. Hitler assured him the Western powers would not intervene. Mussolini asked for and was given a colored map showing the present Czechoslovakia. Hitler explained he was not inclined to accept time-consuming plebiscites in the disputed areas. On the other hand, he said he did not want one Czech village. The events at the quote-unquote Führer building in Munich, bedecked with the flags of the four powers, were inevitably an anticlimax. Chamberlain's plane arrived during the morning. Hitler waited for him with Mussolini and the French Prime Minister, Edouard Daladier, in the smoking room. His major domo had prepared sandwiches and beer there. Since he was asking only for the German-speaking areas and the other three powers were agreeing to this, all that remained was to discuss the modes of transfer, and since the draft agreement that he had handed to Italico yesterday was now being dished up by Mussolini in Italian as though it were his own, the result was a foregone conclusion. The only snag was Hitler's stubborn demand that the Czechs must evacuate the territories immediately, and Chamberlain's equally obstinate defense of the Czech position. Hitler toyed with a watch throughout the morning. He must have borrowed it for the purpose, as he never wore one, as though to hint that he might even now order mobilization at 2 p.m. Between sessions of this languid and untidy conference, the ministers sprawled about on sofas or telephoned their capitals. At one time, Daladier and Hitler were swapping anecdotes from the World War trenches. At another, Chamberlain was regaling him with weekend fishing tales. At 3 p.m., Hitler retired to his apartment for lunch with Himmler and the Italians. He fumed at Chamberlain's obstinacy. Quote, Daladier, now there's a lawyer who sees things as they are and draws the proper consequences. That Chamberlain, however, he has haggled over every village and petty interest like a market stall holder, far worse than the Czechs would have been. What has he got to lose in Bohemia? What's it to do with him? Unquote. Hitler burst out, quote, I never have weekends and I hate fishing, end quote. The taste of victory was turning bitter in his mouth. Quote, it's time Britain stopped playing governess to Europe, unquote, he complained. Quote, if she can't drop her Guardian Act, in the long run, war can't be avoided. And I'll fight that war as long as you and I are still young, Duce, because this war will be a gigantic test of strength for our two countries. End quote. The conference resumed later that afternoon in the small hours of the morning. The Munich Agreement was signed. Before he left, Chamberlain asked if he could see Hitler. Hitler waited at his apartment in Prinzregentenplatz with some curiosity. Not to say impatience, because the elevator bringing up the Englishman wheezed to a halt between floors. Chamberlain asked Hitler for an assurance that, if the Czechs were so vainglorious as to reject the Munich Agreement, the German Air Force would not bomb civilian targets. Hitler gave it. Then Chamberlain produced a sheet of paper containing a typed declaration and asked if Hitler would sign it, saying that this would considerably ease his position in London. Hitler signed it without noticeable enthusiasm. It concluded with the words, quote, We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again." End quote. After the Englishman had left, Ribbentrop came over to the Führer building. Walking down the long flight of steps with him afterward, Ribbentrop mentioned that he was not sure Hitler had been wise to sign such a document. Spitze overheard Hitler's muttered response, quote, "Ach,